Hi, my name is Brad Linscott from the Microsoft Premier Field Engineering Team and Microsoft Support, and today we continue our series on .NET debugging for the production environment. And again, the production environment is where our number one priority is to make sure that the applications are up and running and that the user has a good experience. And so debugging in that environment is a lot different than our, say, our dev machine, because we can't necessarily take time to do what we want to do to collect the data that we want to collect. That's why it's a lot different in the production environment. We'll do a review of some points that we've discussed in previous parts of this series. We'll talk about what managed exceptions are, review about what data we want to collect, as well as some of the common debugger commands that you can use, and whether it's WinDBG, CDB, or the other debuggers in the debugging tools for Windows package, followed by a demo. And it's at this time that we'll have a special guest join us, Mario Hewitt, author of Advanced Windows Debugging and Advanced .NET Debugging. So managed exceptions. We talked about earlier in this series how the exceptions generally fall into one of two categories, either first chance or second chance exceptions. First chance exceptions are by definition non-fatal to the process, but if there's no handler for them, they get promoted to a second chance exception, and that by definition is going to be fatal to the process, and this is when we say the process crashes. Whether it's a managed exception or a .NET exception makes no difference. In .NET, an exception is like anything else. It's an object. It's got members and properties, and it takes up memory. One of the things about managed exceptions that we want to pay attention to with regards to performance issues is that throwing too many too quickly can have a negative performance impact. I've worked with many customers in the past that have had performance penalties caused solely by managed exceptions. One customer that comes to mind is when I first started working with them, we were able to see using Perfmon that they got it was over 100 exceptions per second. I want to think it was somewhere in the neighborhood of about 120. And with working with the customer, scripting the debuggers, finding out what kinds of exceptions were happening, we were able to determine that most of the exceptions were of a single type, and they were DB null exceptions. So we employed a few different techniques to mitigate these exceptions. Some of the database tables we required to have data in so that they could not be null. Other times we went to the application layer where I had the customer first check for the value of the field before they started acting on it, and that would prevent these DB null exceptions. So in Perfmon, one of the things here on the screen that I'm talking about, in the .NET CLR exceptions object, one of the counters that I always pay attention to is the number of exceptions thrown per second. My experience has been that if I find that this number is getting above, say, 15 or so, a lot of times that's usually when there's some kind of performance penalty imposed, whether it's increased CPU time, whether it's an increased memory footprint or slower throughput. A lot of those symptoms are just snowballing off of each other. So, for example, the more objects we create, the more exception objects we create, the more memory that might be committed. The more memory that might be committed, the more GCs we have to perform. And potentially the more GCs we have to perform, the more CPU is consumed. So, as you can see, they can have a real devastating impact on performance. And this particular customer that I was talking about with the DB null exceptions, once we got to work on mitigating these exceptions, he was able to easily get his rate from over 100 exceptions per second down to less than 5 per second. And at that point, he was able to tell me that his throughput, which was measured, I believe, at the time, he told me by requests per second, increased by over 75% just by mitigating that one exception that was causing so much havoc in his application. And again, like we've said with the other problems that we have with application issues in production, the key is to get the data at the exact right time. So with the managed exception, we want to make sure that we get a dump file exactly when the exception is occurring. Because a dump is just a snapshot in time, getting the dump a half second before or a half second later can be too late. The exception object may have been GC'd, and the call stack that represents how the exception occurred could have completely changed, unwound, or the thread may even have been destroyed. Debug Diag and AD Plus are two of the more popular tools that most of our customers use to automate the process of getting an exception at just the right time. And I'll go through a quick demo later on in this session about how we do that. After we get the dump, what are some of the more common debugging commands that we use to analyze and find root cause? We went through some of this in one of the previous parts, but I'll do a quick review right here. bang print exception, or bang PE, is one of the more common commands. If we're able to get a dump at just the right time, I don't have to pass an argument to this command, because if the currently active thread has an exception on it, bang PE will just give me the information about that exception. Otherwise, I need to give it the address of a particular exception object. Bang dump obj may give me more information, such as an inner exception, although bang PE will do the same thing. One thing I tell my customers is that if I find that my exception object has a valid inner exception, you always want to investigate that inner exception. And you keep doing this and digging down into the inner exception until there is no more inner exception. And the reason is because that there's a relationship between an object, an exception object, and its inner exception. It's a causal relationship. The inner exception is what caused the outer exception. Therefore, if we troubleshoot the inner exception first and we resolve it, chances are very good that we won't have that outer exception. And then the same commands that we talked about with hangs, I always like to look at call stack. So any variant of K for the native call stack, or bang CLR stack for the PSS cores on the managed call stack. And there are times also, with exceptions especially, if we're dealing with an application that goes back and forth between the native and the managed world somewhat frequently, like COM interop, we're taking a look deeper inside the code might be helpful. Let's say that there's an example to where you have a function that has 500 lines of code. You've got to dump at the right time. You know the function that's probably at fault for causing the exception in the first place, and he doesn't necessarily have to be the function that's at the very top of the call stack. Sometimes they're further down in the call stack. But if this function has 500 lines of code, how do we determine which line of code is the one responsible for the exception? And that's where the disassembly commands come into play. So in the native world, there's a U command for unassemble, and the PSS cores and SOS have a bang U. And you supply this particular command with an address that's in the instruction pointer column, and I'll talk about this in my demonstration later on about how we can do this to figure out the line of code, or to get a better idea of the line of code where the exception occurs. We talked about this in the previous part of the series when looking at high CPU hangs. We'll do it again here in this demo as well. And as I said at the beginning of the session, we'll have a special guest today to take us through a demonstration of debugging managed exceptions, Mario Hewitt. Mario, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Brad. Thanks for having me.
You bet.
So I've decided to crash the party here a bit.
Great.
And do a quick demonstration of a problem that gets people sometimes.
Okay.
And if we look at the code that we have on the screen here, this is a very simple app. I've kind of slimmed it down to do a repro, right? We've got a simple WinForms app that hosts a browser control. And when the form initializes, first thing we do is spawn a new thread. And that thread will execute the thread func method.
Okay.
If we go down to that method, you'll see that it does not too much, right? It takes a lock on some object, and it doesn't navigate on the browser control, and then it sleeps for a really long time, right? So this lock on some object will be held for quite some time.
Looks like, it's starting to look like we'll have a hang here, but.
Yeah, possibly.
Okay.
Yep. And so once that thread is spawned and it's got the lock, it's sleeping, we spawn off 64 more threads, and they will execute thread func 2.
Okay.
Now, thread func 2 does very little as well. Basically, it just navigates to bing.com.
Okay.
And then it sleeps for a really long time. So 64 threads that are navigating, one thread that holds a lock and is sleeping. Now, what happens when the navigate method is called on the browser control is an event gets sent to the main UI thread. And what I've done in this code is I've registered for the navigate event.
Okay.
And in that event, I try to take a lock on some object, followed by doing something for a really long time.
All right, that's the same object that we had in the first thread func, where we sleep for a long time.
Exactly.
Okay.
So this worker thread has the lock, followed by X number of navigate events that wants to acquire it.
Okay.
So question here is, what should happen here when the main UI thread starts executing navigate?
Well, looking at the source, my guess would be we'd be waiting for quite some time and may simulate a hang.
Yep. So that's exactly what I would expect as well.
Okay, but this talk is on managed exceptions. So
that is true.
I'm guessing maybe
very
I'm
good
off
observation. So let's take a look. Now I'm gonna do a live debug here. This might as well have been a dump.
Okay.
I just happen to do a live debug.
Gotcha.
Also, and you're gonna kill me over this one, I'm gonna use a debugger.
Your favorite one.
My favorite debugger.
Yes.
And TSD. Same thing as WinDBG.
You must
really.
Have worked in the product group at some point in time.
I did for a number of days, years. But it's the same debugger, right?
Right.
You can
right.
do in WinDBG,
exactly.
you can do in NTSD. Right. It's just so happened. I'm a console kind of a guy.
But,
so.
But this is, again, this is one of the debuggers that comes in the debugging tools from
exactly.
Windows package.
So. There's one more, cdb.exe as well, but
right.
anything you can do in either one of them, right?
Absolutely.
So I'll use NTSD, launch browse app. That's what it's called. I'm just going to fix up my symbols. And then just to make sure everything is good, I'll do a sim path, which
okay.
will show me the symbol path.
All right.
And here we can see the magical URL to the Microsoft Public Symbol Server.
Right.
And this is where the symbols are being streamed down from.
Correct.
I'll do a reload. And I'm going to run. And what we should see is a hang, nothing happening, right?
Well, that's what I was guessing. But knowing you, I'm also thinking that I'm being misled here and I might see something else.
All
okay.
Right. So what ends up happening here is we get a Stack Overflow, which we did not expect at all, right?
Right.
So I want to kind of find out why we're getting this. So I'll load the trusty old Less OS.
And this is a 4.0 application.
It's a 4.0, yep. That's why I'm using CLR instead of MS Core Workstation. And I'll do a bang CLR stack. And we got quite a bit of stuff on the stack, right?
Okay.
And we go through some of the internal runtime frames when we finally hit the first navigate method, right? This is the one that we had in our source code. And we expect that to happen.
Okay.
We try to enter the lock, the monitor in this case. We expect that as well. But from here on, I expect the stack to end.
Right? Okay.
Because it should just wait for that to become available.
Right.
As it turns out, I kind of scroll up here. There's a lot more stuff happening. As a matter of fact, we go through a whole bunch of internal .NET framework stuff before we end up in the same method. And again, we're trying to enter the same monitor. And this continues until we exhaust the stack and we get a stack overflow.
Okay.
Right? And the key message here is that if you have a UI thread that's also an STA thread and you do any type of lock acquisition, it is not a blocking wait. As a matter of fact, periodically it will wake up, pump some messages to enable the UI to refresh itself,
okay.
and then continue on running. And that's what we get into this situation. So don't expect on a main UI thread, or UI thread in general, STA, that the lock will be a blocking statement.
Right, and it all piles up behind it.
Yep.
It almost, with the pumping messages, reminds me of the comm world with the well-behaved STA. Is always going to be one that pumps messages all the time.
Yep. So this is something that, it's pretty common. You don't expect that. We've been taught since early days that if a thread is taking a lock, it will wait because the thread cannot make progress until it acquires that lock.
Exactly.
So it's a little bit of an odd scenario, but.
Interesting demo.
Thanks.
Great. Okay.
All right.
Great demo, Mario. I want to take a look at one other demo before we end this session, and that is another WinForms application because they're just so easy to demonstrate these kinds of issues. I'm going to have another exception that we throw here, and this is going to be a possible simulation of what we see in production, although it doesn't have to be the kind of exception that this is going to throw. And again, the point is basically to show how we take all the things that we've learned, put it all together so that we know how to capture the data and do initial analysis of the data to find root cause.
Perfect.
In this case, we throw an exception. To get more information on it, we can see that it's a system.io.directory-not-found exception. Now, it's pretty intuitive from the message box what the problem might be. However, if it's a non-interactive application, like a W3WP or something like that, or if it's in production, we don't always have this kind of luxury. So if this were in production and I had to automate the process of gathering data, what would I do? We'll see if we can put in practice what we've talked about here today to automate the process of gathering data. I'm going to open up one of my trusty friends, Debug Diag, here. And I'm going to go ahead and create what's called a crash rule to automate the process of getting the dump exactly when the exception is thrown so that the dump captures the problem that we want to troubleshoot. So I'm going to go in the wizard and capture information about a specific process. I know what I'm troubleshooting here, so when there's only going to be one netdebugdemos.exe, If it were an application pool for IIS, well, then we would say a specific IIS web application pool. But since that's not the case, I'll type in my application here and go to the next step of the wizard, where debug.dig asks us, what do you want to do and what kind of action do you want to capture? And I want an exception. I already know from the first demonstration that we're having a managed exception. And in this case, it's a 1.0 to 3.5 application. And the .NET exception type I captured was a directory not found exception. And this is key here. I actually have customers that will put typos in when they specify the type of managed exception that they want. And it's important to realize that not only is .NET, do you have to spell the name of the exception correctly, it's case sensitive. So if you don't get the case right, you're not going to get your dump.
And you need the full system, fully qualified.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Let me put it to you this way. Especially when it's a production application, I don't want to take any chances. Mm-hmm. So I always put the full exception in there. And in this case, I don't want a stack trace because that's going to be just something that outputs to a text file. I want to get an actual full dump. And I could also get a mini dump if I want to, but I'm going to get a full dump just
in case. So why the full dump? Why not just, I mean, mini dump to me sounds like it would be smaller, right? And be easier to work with, transfer, or do whatever.
Exactly. They're so much smaller and they get created a lot quicker. The reason I always go for a full user dump is because I don't know necessarily what kind of information I'm going to need in order to find root cause. A mini dump is going to basically have my call stack and my registers. No heap information. And there's a lot of times with these exceptions that we may want to get, not just look at the parameters, but take a look at what's going on in the heap and elsewhere within the process. And that information is not contained in a mini dump, just in a full dump. So okay. I'm going to go ahead and get that. With my exception here that I want to watch out for, I save it and I finish out the wizard. And then debug.dig will show me here that I've already got a dump. So let's go ahead and see if we can delete that from a previous demo. And if I shut down debug, well, it pulls every 1 second or so. So now it shows me I have no dumps. So we can either leave the GUI up or we're going to go ahead and shut it down just to make life a little bit simpler, which is what would really happen on a production server. And I'm going to see if I can reproduce this problem. Now before, when I clicked the button, we got a message box back pretty quickly. Now it's not coming back very quickly at all. And the reason is because we were creating that dump file the whole time. Process execution, as you know, is paused while the dump is being written to file.
So that's actually kind of interesting here, the amount of time it took. One feature that we introduced into Windows 7 and 2008 R2 is called process reflection. And if you have a 24 gig dump file you need to write out, it could take, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes
right,
to do it while the process is...
Process might actually time out.
Exactly. And so they took that process reflection feature, which at a high level clones the dump or the process that you want to dump mm-hmm. on and then creates the dump off the clone. So the process can continue running and then the dump will be taken on that clone. So you won't actually affect the target process.
So
and it's available in Win 7 and 2008 R2.
So the dump would still take an extraordinary amount of time, but it's not going to affect
right.
the process
exactly.
because we're dumping a clone and not the actual mm-hmm. process instance.
And proc dump has a switch on it. You know, that's another tool to generate dump files that supports that now. So
okay.
Yeah.
Good to know. Especially in the 64-bit world.
Yeah.
That's good to know. I've got my dump file in this instance, so I'm gonna go ahead and shut down the process and I'm gonna take a look at the dump that was created. We talked earlier on the slide deck about some of the more common commands that we might use are bang PE. We'll take a look at that for print exception. The debugger tells us here that we've got a dump file that has an exception of interest in it. It's a CLR exception. And most exception codes in 1.0 through 3.5 come across as E0434F4D. So it's probably going to be, I think it's going to be on this thread. Because it was a crash dump, the dump opens on thread 0. So this is where I'm expecting the exception to be, and there it is. One of the first things I usually look at is the inner exception, and in here we don't have one, which tells me the exception that I've captured is really the exception that I want. So I have my exception. The next thing I'm going to do to figure out how the exception occurred was to take a look at the call stack. And so I'm going to look at the managed call stack. And just so folks know, I do have PSS Core 2 loaded here. I'll run bang CLR stack. And I'm always looking towards the top because that's the end of the call stack. This is what resulted, obviously, whenever the exception occurred. I see some custom code here near the top, as followed by some activity here going on in the constructor of the file stream object. So I'm going to focus on this function right here. Now, this is custom code. If I'm working with a customer, I don't necessarily have source code for this function. Every customer that we work with, however, has usually some type of NDA to where it's expected that at some time or other, we're going to look at their source. So if it's a situation to where they can give me the source, then I'll take a look at it. But if it's a situation to where they're having problems with source control, or the guy who's in charge is out sick, or they lost their source or whatever, I can go ahead and take a look at some pseudo source to see what's going on inside this function. So that's what I'm going to do here. The first thing I need to know is, what is the name of the binary that has this function in it? It might be intuitive to say, well, it's got to be this netdebug demos, that's the name of the exe, but I don't know if you've experienced this, but I've worked my share of cases to where functions and classes aren't necessarily named intuitively. I think it's a member of one assembly, but it really has nothing to do with that assembly. So I always want to make sure that I get the right binary that has the function of interest in it. So what I do is I take the instruction pointer in this column of my function of interest, I copy it, and I use the PSS core two functions, IP to method descriptor. And this gives me several different pieces of information, but the one I'm really after is this here called the method table. I want to get the address of this particular internal structure, and once I get him, I copy him to the clipboard, and I use PSS core 2's bang dump method table. This is going to give me, among other things, the path and name of my binary. In this case, it is netdebugdemos.exe. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to go ahead and save this guy out to file using PSS core's save module command. And I want to pull the binary netdebugdemos, making sure to case it correctly. And I want to put it in C temp, and I'll call him blah.exe. And our save is successful.
So what does this blah.exe contain at this point?
Well, it's a representation of the actual binary. I can name it anything I want to. It's really netdebugdemos.exe, and when I decompile, when I put it in a reflector tool, we'll be able to see that it has all the classes and members that my netdebugdemos has. But I can name him whatever I want to when I save him out. So I'm going to open up a free decompiler from Telerik called JustDecompile. And I'm going to navigate to wherever I save this guy out, which is right there. And I need to go back, because I've forgotten in the dump file, what function am I looking for? I am looking for netdebugdemos.sosbasics.accept. So I'm going to continue to expand and navigate down until I get to netdebugdemos. And the next thing I'm looking for is sosbasics. And the next thing I'm looking for is accept. So here's the pseudo source for the function that I believe is heavily involved in the exception. And sure enough, we see that we're looking for a path and file name here that I know on my hard drive doesn't exist, which is why we obviously get the system.io.directory-not-found exception. And this is a very simple sample. I went through earlier in a previous part of this series how to find the line of code, or get really close to the line of code that is causing our problem, because this function is very simple. It's only got 6-7 lines of code, but I've worked with, and I'm sure you have too, my share of code where you've got hundreds of lines of code in a function, and finding the function responsible is just half the battle. If you've got 1,000 lines of code in there, how do you figure out which one caused the problem?
Mm-hmm.
And this is when I leverage SOS's bang u command. So we'll come back over here to our dump file. I want to take the instruction pointer once again for my function of interest. And if I want to see or get an idea of where we were in the function when the exception occurred, I'll use bang u and I'll pass the instruction pointer there. And if I've got a lot of instructions in here, I can go on for pages and pages in WinDBG. It always helps to have these arrows, because this points out the address that I specified in my bang u command. So if I'm looking for some kind of clue here as to where we are in the code, I want to take a look at where I might be when I'm trying to run the constructor for a file stream object. And it might be There's my file stream right there. That's where I create my file stream. So this is where we are when the exception occurred, and of course we're trying to open up a path and file name that don't exist. So that's it for that quick demo. Mario, thanks a ton for coming on board and showing us one of your demos and also talking about some of the new things in Windows 7. We'll see if we can have you back pretty soon.
Sounds good. Thanks.
Thank you.